On ideas, you're listening to the 1988 Massey Lectures by Noam Chomsky. Part 5. The Case of Vietnam.
Operations of domestic thought control are commonly undertaken in the wake of wars and other crises. The reason is that these tend to encourage the so-called crisis of democracy, that is, the persistent fear of privileged elites. And that requires measures to reverse the thrust of popular democracy that threatens established power. Wilson's Red Scare served the purpose after World War I, and the pattern was reenacted when World War II ended. The Vietnam War and the popular movements of the 1960s elicited similar concerns. The inhabitants of enemy territory at home had to be controlled and suppressed so as to restore the ability of U.S. corporations to compete in the more diverse world market by reducing real wages and welfare benefits and weakening working class organization. Young people in particular had to be convinced that they must be concerned only for themselves, that they must share in a culture of narcissism. Other newly mobilized sectors of the special interests also had to be restrained or dissolved. These tasks sometimes required a degree of force, as we learn from the programs of the FBI, to undermine the ethnic movements and the other elements of the rising dissident culture by instigating violence or sometimes the direct exercise of violence and by other means of intimidation and harassment. Another task was to overcome the dread Vietnam syndrome that impeded the resort to forceful means to control the dependencies. Commentary editor Norman Podhoretz explained that the task was to overcome what he called the sickly inhibitions against the use of military force that developed in revulsion against the Indochina wars. This problem was resolved, he hoped, in the glorious conquest of Grenada, when 6,000 elite troops succeeded in overcoming the resistance of several dozen Cubans and some Grenadian militiamen, winning 8,000 medals of honor for their prowess. To overcome the Vietnam syndrome, it was necessary to present the United States as the aggrieved party and the Vietnamese as the aggressors. That's a difficult task, you might think, at least those who are unfamiliar with the measures available for controlling the public mind might think so. The mechanisms by which a more satisfactory version of history was established have been reviewed elsewhere, but a few words are in order as to their remarkable success. By 1977, President Jimmy Carter was able to explain in a news conference that we have no need to apologize or to castigate ourselves or to assume the status of culpability, and we do not owe a debt. The reason, he said, is because our intentions were to defend the freedom of the South Vietnamese and because the destruction was mutual. That pronouncement passed without comment to my knowledge, apparently being considered as quite reasonable. Such balanced concern, incidentally, is not limited to soulful advocates of human rights. It appears quite regularly, evoking no comment. I'll take a current case. After the shooting down of an Iranian civilian airliner by the U.S. Navy, the Boston Globe ran a column by political scientist Jerry Ho of Duke University and the Brookings Institute, in which he explained that, I'm quoting him now, if the disaster in the downing of the Iranian airliner leads this country to move away from its obsession with symbolic nuclear arms control and to concentrate on the problems of war fighting, command and control of the military, and limitations of conventional weapons, then 290 people will not have died in vain. That's an assessment that differs slightly from the media barrage after the downing of KAL-007 by the Russians. A New York Times editorial obliquely took exception to President Carter's interesting moral judgment that we owe no debt because the destruction was mutual. Under the heading, "The Indochina Debt That Lingers," the editors observed that no debate over who owes whom how much can be allowed to obscure the worst horrors of our involvement in Southeast Asia. Here they are referring to the horrors experienced by many of those in flight from the communist monsters. At the time, that was a small fraction of the many hundreds of thousands fleeing their homes in Asia, including 100,000 boat people from the Philippines in 1977 and thousands fleeing U.S.-backed terror in Timor, not to speak of hundreds of thousands more escaping the U.S.-backed terror states of Latin America. None of them merited such concern, or even more than cursory notice in the news columns, if that. It is beyond imagining in responsible circles that the United States might have some culpability for mass slaughter and for leaving three countries in ruins, or owe some debt to the millions of maimed and orphaned, or to the peasants who still die from exploding ordnance left from the U.S. assault. Meanwhile, the Pentagon, when asked whether there's any way to remove the hundreds of thousands of anti-personnel bomblets that kill children today in such areas as the Plain of Chars in Laos, comments helpfully that people should not live in these areas. They know the problem. The situation is quite different with regard to Afghanistan. In that case, press headlines read, "Mines put Afghans in peril on return. U.S. rebukes Soviets on Afghan mine clearing." The difference is that these are Soviet mines, so it's only natural for the United States to call for an international effort to provide the refugees with training and equipment to destroy or dismantle them, and to denounce the Russians for their lack of cooperation in this worthy endeavor. The press responds with the usual selective humanitarian zeal. The media are not satisfied with mutual destruction, that he faces all responsibility for major war crimes. Rather, the burden of guilt must be shifted to the victims. Under the heading, "Vietnam trying to be nicer still has a long way to go," New York Times Asia correspondent Barbara Crosset quotes Charles Prince of Human Rights Advocates International, who says that it's about time the Vietnamese demonstrated some goodwill. Prince is referring to negotiations about the Amerasian children, who constitute a tiny fraction of the victims of U.S. aggression in Indochina. Crosset adds that the Vietnamese have also not been sufficiently forthcoming on the matter of the remains of American soldiers, though their behavior may be improving. "There has been progress, albeit slow, on the missing Americans," she writes, "but the Vietnamese have not yet paid their debt to us, so humanitarian concerns left by the war remain unresolved." Crosset also quotes a Pentagon statement expressing the hope that Hanoi will take action to resolve this long-standing humanitarian issue of the remains of U.S. servicemen shot down over North Vietnam by the evil communists. That's the only humanitarian issue that comes to mind, apparently, when we consider the legacy of the war. Another report deplores Vietnamese refusal to cooperate in key humanitarian areas, quoting liberal congressmen on Hanoi's horrible and cruel behavior and Hanoi's responsibility for lack of progress on humanitarian issues, meaning the matter of U.S. servicemen still missing from the Vietnam War. The same report in the press continues, "Hanoi's recalcitrance brought back the bitter memories that Vietnam can still evoke among the suffering Americans." So profound are the humanitarian impulses that guide this deeply moral society that even the right-wing senator, John McCain, is now calling for diplomatic relations with Vietnam. "He holds no hatred for the Vietnamese," he says, "even though he's a former Navy pilot who spent 5.5 years as an unwilling guest in the Hanoi Hilton," as a North Vietnamese prisoner, editor David Greenway of the Boston Globe comments. And Greenway adds, "If McCain can put aside his bitterness, so can we all." The educated community he addresses would not find it odd to urge that we overcome our natural bitterness against the Vietnamese for what they did to us. These examples illustrate the power of the system of manufacture of necessary illusions, at least among the educated elites who are the prime targets of propaganda and its purveyors. It would be difficult to conjure up an achievement that might lie beyond the reach of mechanisms of indoctrination that can portray the United States as an innocent victim of Vietnam.
The 1988 CBC Messy Lectures continue on ideas, presented by Noam Chomsky. Part 6, Worthy Victims, the Case of Central America.
Throughout the period of U.S. global hegemony, there has been no hesitation to resort to force if the welfare of U.S. elites is threatened by what top-level planning documents describe as the threat of nationalistic regimes that are responsive to popular demands, I'm quoting, for improvement in the low living standards of the masses and production for domestic needs, and that seek to control their own resources. To counter such threats, the top-secret planning documents explain, the U.S. must encourage a political and economic climate conducive to private investment of both foreign and domestic capital. This must include opportunity to earn, and in the case of foreign capital, to repatriate a reasonable return. The means, it is frankly explained, must ultimately be force, because such policies somehow fail to gain much popular support and are constantly threatened by what are called subversive forces. If the media are to serve their societal purpose, such matters as these must be beyond the pale, remote from public awareness, and the massive evidence provided by the documentary record and evolving history must be consigned to dusty archives or marginal publications. We may speak in retrospect of blunders, misinterpretation, personal failings, even corruption and deceit on the part of leaders gone astray. But the study of institutions and how they function must be scrupulously ignored, apart from fringe elements or a relatively obscure scholarly literature. These results have been quite satisfactorily achieved. In capitalist democracies of the Third World, the situation is often much the same. Costa Rica, for example, is rightly regarded as the model democracy of Latin America. The press is firmly in the hands of the ultra-right, so there need be no concern over freedom of the press in Costa Rica, and none is voiced in the mainstream. In this case, the result was not achieved by force, but rather by the free market, assisted by legal measures to control so-called communists, and apparently an influx of North American capital in the 1960s. Where such means have not sufficed to enforce the approved version of democracy and freedom of the press, others are readily available and are considered right and proper as long as they succeed. El Salvador in the past decade provides a dramatic illustration. In the 1970s, there was a proliferation of popular organizations, many sponsored by the church, including peasant associations and self-help groups, unions, and so on. The reaction was a violent outburst of state terror, which continues, organized by the United States with bipartisan backing and general media support as well. Any residual qualms dissolved after fraudulent elections had been conducted for the benefit of the home front. Meanwhile, the Reagan administration ordered a reduction in the more visible terror when the population was judged to be sufficiently traumatized, and it appeared that torture, murder, mutilation, and disappearance were beginning to pose problems back home in the United States. There had been an independent press in El Salvador, including two newspapers, La Crónica and El Independiente. They were destroyed in 1980 and 1981 by the security forces. The editor of La Crónica and a photographer were taken from a San Salvador coffee shop and hacked to pieces with machetes. The editor of El Independiente fled after three assassination attempts, arrest and torture of staff members, and occupation and destruction of the plant by the armed forces. Concern for these matters was so high in the United States that there was not one word in the New York Times news columns reporting the facts, and not one editorial comment. The editor who fled was indeed permitted a statement on the opinion page in which he condemned the Duarte Junta for having succeeded in extinguishing the expression of any dissident opinion, and expressed his belief that the so-called death squads are nothing more or less than the military itself. That was the limit of the coverage. It's not that the U.S. media are unconcerned with freedom of the press in Central America. Media critic Francisco Goldman counted 263 references to the tribulations of the Nicaraguan newspaper La Prensa in the New York Times in the past 4 years. The distinguishing criterion is not obscure. The Salvadoran newspapers were independent voices stilled by the murderous violence of U.S. clients. La Prensa is an agency of the U.S. campaign to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. Therefore, it is a worthy victim whose harassment calls forth anguish and outrage. Before the editor of La Crónica was murdered and mutilated, he visited New York to plead for international pressure to deter terrorists from destroying his paper. He reported that he had received threats from a death squad that undoubtedly enjoys the support of the military, and that two bombs had been found in his house, that the paper's offices were machine-gunned and set afire, and his home surrounded by soldiers. These problems began, he said, when his paper began to demand reforms in landholdings. This angered the dominant classes. There was no response to his appeal, no international pressure developed, and he was murdered. But in fact, four bombings of his paper in the preceding 6 months had received 70 words prior to his assassination. In El Salvador, the church radio station was repeatedly bombed, and troops occupied the Archdiocese building, destroying the radio station and ransacking the newspaper offices. Once again, this elicited no reaction. Nor have the New York Times Central America correspondents reported that leading church figures who have fled from El Salvador, including a close associate of the assassinated Archbishop Romero, cannot return to the death squad democracy they applaud for fear of assassination. Times editors call upon the Reagan administration to use its pressure on behalf of peace and pluralism in Nicaragua. No such strictures apply to El Salvador. In such ways as these, with selective humanitarian zeal and careful selection of the kinds of evidence that can reach the public, the free press works to implant the illusions that are necessary to control the domestic enemy.
The 1988 Massey Lectures continue tomorrow night on Ideas, presented by Noam Chomsky. Several weeks ago, Professor Chomsky presented some of the material in these lectures to an audience at Ryerson Polytechnical Institute in Toronto, after which he was questioned by a panel of Canadian journalists. You'll hear parts of that panel discussion each night this week. This is David Frum, associate editor of Saturday Night Magazine.
You say that what the media do is to ignore certain kinds of atrocities that are committed by us and our friends, mm-hmm. and to play up enormously atrocities that are committed by them and our enemies. And you posit, in fact, you say in the Massey Lectures that there's a test of integrity and moral honesty, which is to have a kind of equality of treatment of corpses.
Equality of principles.
I mean, that every dead person should be in principle equal to every other dead person.
That's not what I say at all.
Well, I'm glad that's not what you say, because that's not what you do.
Of course it's not what I do, nor would I say it. I say the opposite. What I say is that we should be responsible for our own actions primarily. That's something quite different.
But with 100 priests.
I wasn't equating them. I was comparing the treatment of them. If you want my value judgment, we should give much more attention to one priest who we've killed than to 100 priests that they've killed. Notice that this is exactly the...
Isn't your method?
That's exactly my method.
Because your method is to ignore... Not only to ignore the corpses created by them, but also to ignore the corpses that are created by neither side, but which are irrelevant to your ideological
agenda. That's totally untrue.
Well, let me give you an example.
Okay.
One of your own causes that you take very seriously is the cause of the Palestinians, and a Palestinian corpse weighs very heavily on your conscience, and yet a Kurdish corpse does not.
That's not true at all. I've been involved in Kurdish support groups for years. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely false. I mean, just ask the people who are involved in... I mean, you know, they come to me, I sign their petitions, and so on and so forth.
And in fact,
if you look at the things we've written, I mean, let's take a look. I mean, I'm not Amnesty International. I can't do everything. I'm a single university person. But if you read, take a look at the book that Edward Herman and I wrote on this topic. We wrote a book about this in 1979. In it, we discuss three kinds of atrocities, not two, three kinds of bloodbaths. What we called benign bloodbaths, which nobody cares about, constructive bloodbaths, which are the ones we like, and nefarious bloodbaths, which are the ones that the bad guys do. Constructive bloodbaths are things like the Indonesian massacres, which we supported. Nefarious bloodbaths are like Pol Pot. But we also discussed ones that nobody cares about, like Burundi. For example, we have probably the only discussion in the literature, I guess, of the massacres that were going on in Burundi at that time. We probably have the only discussion in the literature, at least that I know of the massacres that were going on in Burma. Now, in fact, not only is what you say not true, but it's the opposite of the truth. We went out of our way to find the kinds of bloodbaths that are just ignored because nobody cares about them. Now, again, let me stress, I'm not Amnesty International. I do not have the, either the, I don't have, you know, the ludicrous egotism which makes me the arbiter of all atrocities over the world, right? I'm not trying to give an A to this country and a B-minus to this country and so on. The principle that I think we ought to follow is not the one that you stated. It's the principle that we rightly expect Soviet dissidents to follow. So what principle do we expect Sakharov to follow, let's say? What lets us decide whether Sakharov's a moral person? I think he is. Sakharov does not treat every corpse as atrocity as identical. He has nothing to say about American atrocities. And when he's asked, he says, I don't know anything about them. I don't care about them. What he talks about is Soviet atrocities. And that's right, because those are the ones that he's responsible for. It's a very simple ethical point. You're responsible for the predictable consequences of your actions. You're not responsible for the predictable consequences of somebody else's actions. Now, we understand this when we're talking about dissidents in the Soviet Union, okay? But we refuse to understand it when we're talking about ourselves for very good reasons. Commissars in the Soviet Union don't understand it about dissidents. Commissars in the Soviet Union attack Sakharov and other dissidents because they don't talk about American crimes, right? We understand exactly why that's just hypocrisy and cynicism when they do it, and we should understand the same when we do it. Now, the fact of the matter is that I spend a fair amount of effort on crimes of official enemies. There are a fair number of people in the United States and Canada from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe who are there because of my personal activities on their behalf. But I don't take any pride in that particularly. I just do it because I'm interested in it. The most important thing for me and for you is to think about the consequences of your actions. What can you affect? Those are the ones you primarily ought to be concerned about. Of course, every corpse is a corpse, but there's some that you can affect and there are others you can't do much about. You know, like I can be worried about things that happened in the 18th century, but I can't do much about them.
We're at Ryerson Polytechnical Institute in Toronto for a panel discussion about Noam Chomsky's 1988 Massey Lectures. This is Peter Worthington, editor of the Ottawa Sun.
It strikes me that you're living refutation of the thesis that you can't get a certain point of view across. You've hardly been a shrinking violet over the past 30 years, but it seems to me the effect of your theme has been virtually zilch, except for a few of the elite who support it. It seems to me the great mass of the American people, the workers, either don't understand it or reject it totally.
First of all, I don't agree with your factual assumption. I think it's exactly the opposite of the truth. What you said is that you said correctly that I haven't been a shrinking violet, and you said the effect has been zilch except for elements of the elite. The facts are exactly the opposite. The effects on the elite are zero, and the effects on the general population are not insignificant. I'm one person. There are a lot of people doing this sort of thing, and we have much greater outreach than we've ever had before, not through the elite media. I mean, I travel around the country all the time. I can't accept a fraction of the invitations that come. I'm booked up solidly 2 years in advance, and I probably don't accept maybe 10% of the invitations that come in.
The thesis works well for you.
But, see, there's a reason for that. That was not true 20 years ago. When I got started in this, I was talking to people. If I could talk to three neighbors in a living room, I'd consider it a good evening. You know, I was giving talks on the Boston Common, where we had to be protected by the police to prevent us from being murdered. And that was going on until 1966, you know. Boston is a liberal city, incidentally, and this was with the support of the media.
But the media wasn't ignoring you.
Oh, totally, totally.
Well,
there are a lot of illusions about this. In the 1960s, the media were completely closed to anybody like me. That includes public radio, for example. The most liberal segment of the American media probably National Public Radio in Boston, where I live, and I'm not unknown. During the entire Vietnam War, when I was very well known for opposition to the war, I was on National Public Radio once for, I think, 5 minutes, if I remember, after I came back from Vietnam with an extremely hostile interview by the most liberal commentator, Louis M. Lyons. That was it. Now, I could never be in the newspapers or anything of that sort. By the early 70s, it began to change a little. And by the late 70s, it changed more. And in the 1980s, it's considerably more. I mean, it's still very limited. But if I wanted to, I could probably at this point, say, write op-eds for quality local press, not the New York Times, but, say, the Minneapolis Star Tribune or something. That was unimaginable in the 60s.
Yeah, but that's the elite, surely.
It's not. No, you see, but that's a reflection of... See, I think that's missing the point. In the elites are about as closed as they always were. But the general population has changed, and that's beginning to affect the institutions. I mean, outreach to the general population is much easier than before. No, I mean, I gave my own experience, but other people do the same, have the same experience. You talk to much wider groups, much bigger audiences. They're much more sophisticated. I mean, in the peak of the peace movement, I was always cutting corners. I would never say what I thought. I never talked about the U.S. attack against South Vietnam in the 1960s, even in student activist groups, because they wouldn't know what I'm talking about. Nowadays, I never talked about institutions. I never criticized. Today I talked a little about capitalist democracy. I'd never talk about that kind of thing in the 60s. It was just too exotic, you know. But I don't cut any corners anymore anywhere. I can be giving a talk in eastern Kentucky or, central Iowa or something else, and I say exactly what I think, and people generally understand it. They may not agree. They may be surprised, but they want to listen and they want to think about it. Those are changes outside of the elite circles.